The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now it's True Wealth, presented by Little John Financial Services. Here is David Littlejohn with True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week, the best Tuesday you've had all week. We are stoked to have you on the show. This is Dave Littlejohn joining me in studio.
Matt Dixon.
Matt, what's the price of Bitcoin?
Oh, gosh, I think it's been falling pretty steadily. Is it in the 30s?
No, it went up the last 2 days.
Did it?
We've got the weirdest stuff. You know what?
Is it in the 40s already?
Yeah, so last year Bitcoin did 25.95% roughly. If we go back 1 year from today. So it's amazing. It's up, you know, about 26%. And you know what else was about that same performance?
I don't know.
S&P 500.
Yeah. Wow.
I know. Everybody's like, I should go buy crypto, right? And I'm like, or the stock market.
Have you been seeing Ethereum, though? It's really getting beat up.
It's all over the board getting hammered. And, you know, we live in interesting times, right? And I don't know if that's that the proverb, prayer, good, bad, or otherwise. Like, may you live in interesting times. Is that a blessing or a curse?
I mean, it's interesting. It's I mean, you never know what you're gonna get. I mean, the fires down in Colorado that happened, like a wildland fire in the middle of the wintertime.
Yeah.
Who would have thought that's gonna happen?
Quite unheard of. Yeah. So. Here, we've been discussing what shall we discuss on the show today. And here's kind of the takeaway that I think our investors and our listeners need to hear.
By the way, our listeners are awesome. We were looking at some stats on that. And
yeah. We
have like a really good following in New York and Singapore. Like, we want to give a shout out to those listeners.
Right. Well, I think this is kind of awesome that, so first of all, our podcast, we finally got it figured out how to get it distributed a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting platformed out there into different areas, which I guess that's a term, right? It's not deplatformed. That's good. I'm sure we'll upset somebody at some point, right? I mean, I have
it. Of course.
I know I do. But what we want to talk about is just the weirdness of the world.
Okay.
And some of the things that we see going on, and I want to give some context to our listeners. So we're going to really talk about the markets today, like the stock market.
Are we really going to get into the juicy details? I like it.
So we're going to try to. I think we're going to cover a smattering of things that folks, I believe, ought to be paying attention to. And I'm going to give a frame up. There's going to be a lot of examples, a lot of stories, and we're just going to try to provide some context, ways to think about this, because here's going to be the basic premise of the show, okay? When it comes to investing, you need to fire your emotions.
Okay.
All right?
I can get on board with
right?
this.
And the idea behind this is, we've used this analogy on the show before, but again, if you're just joining us or you've not listened before, and now that we're getting, like Singapore, somebody's listening to this, keep in mind that one of the big rules for surgeons, especially in the emergency room, when you're in a high pressure, game on environment, I mean, you're talking about somebody comes in and it is life or death situations and you need to get to work, okay? Emergency room docs don't operate on their own family.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
I feel like you're going to be a little bit shakier with your hands. Yeah. Like, oh my gosh, this is my own child, you know?
Yeah, it's already stressful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's a super high stress environment. And when you throw that emotional mix in on top of it, yikes. So why is it okay for a doc to operate on somebody else but not their family?
They've done it 1,000 times, right?
Yeah, it's
they
training.
Have experience. Yeah.
Yeah. Right? I mean, remember, our natural fight or flight response is to defend oneself or run.
Mm-hmm.
So in a danger or a stress environment, the natural response is oftentimes flee, right? This is also what's remarkable about our emergency responders. What person in their right mind runs into a burning building?
Yeah, you've got to have a different type of mindset for that.
Well, and if you were to just take any Joe Schmo off the street, or Jane Schmo, if that's the case, right? We're not playing
favorites
here. Wow,
so PC today, David.
Well, I will say, as long as Jane's capable of passing the physical requirements, have at it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Is if you were to take any person off the street and just say, throw on this gear and go fight a fire.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that ends badly, right? That more than likely ends very, very badly, because that person has no training to be prepared for what to do.
When to say, hey, you know, these flames are too big.
On,
yeah.
Right?
I got to turn around and get out of here. The
and
house
so
is going to collapse.
If that is the case, you're really taking on an inordinate amount of risk to do that. It's not that firefighters don't have significant risks when they're engaged in fighting a fire, but the training helps, to the extent possible, mitigate that risk.
Similar
right?
to what we're doing.
And that's why docs we don't want to emotionally compromise an already stressed environment. And that's where investors, we're encouraging you to fire your emotions. That is way easier said than done.
Well, and the training piece you just mentioned too.
That's the part that helps. People often ask me, hey, do you freak out when the markets are going up or down really big? And when the markets are going up, I'm actually more likely to freak out on an up day than a down day. I mean, it's I like up days, but I'm usually sort of suspicious.
Mm-hmm. like why?
why does everybody think it's all of a sudden way better? And so that's when the eyebrow raises a little bit. And I'm like, But when the market goes down really big, I have the same gut reaction that everybody does, right? I mean, we think about, some Monday morning, Matt's texting me going, hey, what are we going to do? And what was my response?
Do we need to do anything today, or can it wait till tomorrow?
Right. And why tomorrow?
Because we had an advisor meeting, and that's when we were planning to discuss it. But I'm over here like, hey, you know, I'm seeing a lot of red on the screen. The S&P's looking rough. Do we need to do something here? And you're like...
And that is not an indictment on you, Matt.
Oh, no.
Right? Like, that was totally within your right, and it was a good question to ask, right?
Because
that's really what it was. Matt wasn't freaking out. Matt was saying, hey, our job is to be aware of what's going on here for our customers. So do we need to do something?
Yeah.
And what I said is... Well, we need to take all of this data into our analysis. We need to, you know, sort of distill it, chew on it, figure out what it means, and then we want to take meaningful action if and when appropriate.
And later that day, the markets started to creep back into position, and then today
they went up.
So,
and here's the thing: does that mean we just got an all clear signal?
No.
No, absolutely. Go invest everything. No, of course not. No. It doesn't mean that we got an all clear signal. It does mean that today we had some news that was decent, right? The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell was essentially reconfirmed, right? So he's sticking around.
Were you surprised the markets moved the way they did off that news?
No.
No? Okay. No,
so keep in mind that when the Fed speaks, one of the things that the Federal Reserve has tried to really do is they're engineering something they call a soft landing. Okay. Now, when I think of a soft landing, I picture like a bird trying to land on a post, right? So what does it do? It kind of faces into the wind, spreads its wings and sort of arches and slows down, and then it sort of settles and just drops down on a spot. And it's amazing the precision that a bird, you know, a bird can land on a wire. Bird can land on a stump. They have these precision landings. If you or I were to jump from a run and try to stick the landing, it's a really low probability we pull it off with that level of finesse. So how you engineer a soft landing, though, well, that's kind of how the bird is manipulating the variables that it can to try to get to that exact spot. And the Fed's trying to do that.
Yeah.
One of the ways they do that is through messaging.
Give me an example.
What they say is important. How they say it is also important. As an example, the markets, you can look at, you can buy futures for lots of things. Right? You can buy futures on crops, meaning, farmer planted a crop. I'm going to buy the future yield on that crop. And then every day after that, you're looking at the reports to see whether or not the crop's going to have a high yield or a low yield to see if you just made a good investment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Really low yield or really lousy crop year, maybe you overpaid, maybe you underpaid, and you're going to get to sell it at a premium later because your option that you purchased for the future is going to end up in a better position for you. Well, markets handicap interest rates in a similar futures environment as well, looking at the problem. And so you can look at how the market is sort of voting with their money and saying, well, the Federal Reserve more or less said we anticipate 3 rate hikes for the year. And what the markets looked at in the futures markets said, we think there might be more than that. Right? Not like a guarantee, but we think that there's a probability, maybe a 20-25% chance that there's a 4th rate hike this year.
Yeah, that's
okay. And that's enough of a probability that you don't ignore it.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And so the markets get a little nervous going, okay, well, what we just heard, this is the classic case of like arguing with somebody that's passive aggressive. So when you say to them, this is all I meant. And they say, what I heard you say was this thing that you didn't say. Right. And so the Fed has to play that game with everybody.
That'd be tiring.
Yeah. So here's Jerome Powell saying, we're going to have to raise rates to slow down the economy. And then everybody goes, they're going to kill the economy. And then they go, hold it. We're slowing it down because it's doing so well. And everybody says, well, but so you want to stop that? They go, no, we don't want to stop it. But if we don't intervene, inflation's going to run away. I did a couple of people scoff and go, what do you mean going to run away? Right? What are we looking at right now?
This is a beautiful illustration, by the way.
You can see what's happening. Because inflation largely in many areas is running away.
Mm-hmm.
And companies are reporting huge increases in the input costs to get, like food suppliers are saying, we can't get the food and the food we get is super expensive. Okay, yeah. That's inflationary. It gets passed on to the consumer. And so the Fed is saying, and I'm using the Fed and Jerome Powell sort of interchangeably here, but the Fed's saying, okay, look, we need to do something to stabilize prices. We can't have runaway inflation because there's no way to price that in. And if we have runaway inflation, nobody's going to buy bonds because who wants to loan money out for super cheap when your dollar's losing purchasing power 6 ways from Sunday?
Who has been buying bonds lately?
The Fed.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's really, it's a great question. That's a great comment, Matt. Let's do this. Let's pick up on the other side of the break.
Okay.
When you said, hey, who's buying and why the Fed is still trying to do this passive-aggressive nuance. But yes, so there's music. We'll take a quick break, but I want you to stick around because it's all going to come back together as we're trying to look into the future and try to take some of the clouds out of the crystal ball. We'll be right back. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
All right, Matt, they're playing our song. We can come back.
Are we back?
We're back.
Are we live?
I hope so.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, gang, for tuning in. And if we weren't live, then that's what podcasts are for. Available at littlejohnfs.com and now on Amazon Music, on Apple iTunes, and lots of other podcast environments that you can yank them out of there. So,
are we popular yet, David?
No, we're just...
We're working on it,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, we're working on it. And so share it with a friend, right? So here we are. We're going to try to drop some more knowledge. We're talking about looking at the markets and what's wacky. And I know I joked about Bitcoin at the start, and then we kind of threw the Fed into the mix. And what I want to do is less weeds, more moving through this, right?
Okay.
We know that the Fed has to nuance stuff because there's all these things that are pushing and pulling in the economy right now. And these are very real things that as investors we need to think about. We also need to consider what are leading indicators and what are lagging indicators. Okay, you know what I mean by that?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so some of them are the things that are going to happen early, and then some of the things, they sort of confirm something that happened because after it's done, it's like, yep, there we go. That's what follows. An example, stock market is largely considered a leading economic indicator.
Mm-hmm. We were kind of talking about that during our call this morning.
Yes, right? Yeah. That the economy is something that is usually follows the stock market. So if the stock market's going up, then the economy tends to go up too. And a lot of this is because what the stock market is attempting to do is factor in future values, right? Mm-hmm. So it's looking at the present value of something and trying to discern what the future value will be. And so it's going to try to look at how much expected growth is going to be there. Okay. And there's that, these are big, you know, paint with a roller concepts. I'm not getting down to the nitty gritty of it here. But what we know is that if, and this is where we left in the last segment, right? Who's buying bonds right now? We talked about if inflation's running away, then it's a great time to borrow money when it's cheap if you're going to get to pay it back with weaker dollars, right? Mm-hmm. If I can borrow money at 1% interest, but I can make 15% interest in my investments.
Right, like you know the hikes are coming.
I should borrow as much money as possible and then leverage what I can to make a bunch of money. We call the difference between the rate that you can borrow for and the rate that you can earn an arbitrage, right? That's the difference. You're arbitraging or making a difference in your lending rates between the two. Mm-hmm. It's essentially how banks operate, by the way. Banks call it a spread, right? Their net operating income is the spread between the money that they take in and the money that they lend out and how much money they're earning on the lending and how much it costs them on the money to take in.
Yeah.
Because it actually, like you putting a deposit in the bank, banks live in opposite land. It's not an asset for a bank when they get a deposit. It's a liability. Because now they have to pay interest on that thing, which we all laugh. I get it. Banks aren't paying any interest on anything right now if it's like unless it's in a CD or something and it's really low, even then. But like your savings account, interest. What a cute idea. I remember when that happened decades ago. But if that's normally how it would work, right? So if we see inflation run away, though, here's how this works. Nobody's willing to loan, right? I'm not going to let you borrow money from me if I'm going to get paid back with nothing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to make a loan. And that's what the bond market is, right? The bond market is people buying the bond, they're loaning money. And then the bond is a payment of income stream with a balloon payment at a later date that pays the lender back. That's what the bond is. And yeah, there's a different way that it fits in the capital structure and so forth. But let's not overcomplicate this for this radio show. Let's just understand that. Are you going to make a loan to somebody else on the super cheap so that they can pay you back with less purchasing power?
No.
No. And so if you're not willing to make that loan, what's going to happen? Nobody wants the bond. So if somebody wants to borrow money, what are they going to have to do? Pay you more interest.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's the issue here. And if you already loaned your money out to somebody else and you want to sell your loan to somebody else, and banks do this all the time, bonds trade all over the place after their initial purchase. It's called the secondary market, right? But if a bond is traded after its issue date and the interest rates have changed,
it's either going to be at a premium or at a discount.
Well, yeah, you may have, if you want to sell your bond and it's earning 1% and today's bonds are earning 10%, nobody wants your 1% bond.
You're selling it at a discount.
Yeah, you're going to have to cut that price to the basement and unload that thing and take a hit for it, right? And so that's the issue at play here is if nobody's willing to lend money, then the borrowers have to pay up. So rates go up and up and up. So people think that the Fed sets interest rates. No, the Fed starts the interest rate trend. They influence it.
They start rolling that snowball down the hill.
Yep, but the market decides, right? The market decides by whether you or me or some institution, I guess you or I, am willing to loan the money.
It'll be interesting to see at the end of the year where they end up.
Right. So we are seeing this trend and this commitment to the Fed attempting to raise rates. And the market is likely to do this as well, naturally, because when inflation is really, really high, you're going to see people unwilling to loan money at low rates. So as the rates go up, it's called an increase in the cost of capital. It means companies that are borrowing money to grow, it's going to cost them more to borrow. And that higher cost means higher expenses. Higher expenses means lower margin. Lower margin means slower growth. Slower growth then gets reflected in the stock market. And markets, as a leading indicator, will start to anticipate, a decline in the rate of growth, which affects the future value. Now you're seeing the dots start to connect.
Yeah, and it hits the tech sector first, wouldn't you say?
Well, it is right now. The tech sector is seeing it. So here's two examples, not to be confused as financial advice. We disclose that all the time, so don't go out and try to invest on this per se, but think on it. It may inform investment decisions. Okay, it's just not investment advice. So if you're a tech company and you can borrow money for super cheap and you're growing it, if you're growing at 10, 15% a year or more, and you can borrow money for 3%, you know what you do?
Borrow it.
All day long,
right?
And you funnel it back into growth. But if you're a company that's growing, let's say you could get money for 3%, but all of a sudden it goes up to 6%.
You're going to pump the brakes.
Well, it's going to double your cost of capital.
Yeah.
That changes. When people say business model, right? It's like the math behind all the different things connected in the business. So the business model is, well, how much do I have to pay these people? And how much do I have to buy to produce this widget and sell it for this much to make a profit after and then pay taxes and everything and make it worth it, right? This is the idea that if prices of your inputs go up too much, you can lose money in business and then you're out of business.
Yeah.
So the business model can fail if the variables that are assumed for how the operation prices things change too dramatically.
And like, the rates have been really low for a really long time.
Yeah.
So businesses have adapted to that.
Let's think about real life here. We live in like the timber capital of the known universe.
Yeah.
Right. And so if log prices drop way, way low, then we see the mills begin to shut down and lay people off.
Yes.
Because they can't operate at, you know, it can cost more to process the logs than they can earn to pay for the operation. So you scale the operation back. And that's also why sometimes they're operating at a loss just because it's more expensive to shut something down and then try to turn it back on when the pricing conditions improve than it is to try to hold your breath and just stop as much bleeding as possible until you can turn the spigot back on.
Right.
So those are other business decisions that get made, and that happens all over the place. So if rates change a lot, oh, buddy, it'll affect things. And so tech is interest sensitive. Can you think of a different type of industry that could benefit from rates going up?
Banks. Banking.
Yeah.
I mean, they're making more money.
Why?
Because they're able to, the lending changes, the way that they're lending money.
Right.
They're getting a higher return.
Because what you'll likely see is banks are unlikely to increase what they pay as interest to gather deposits because there are lots of places for banks to go right now. They can borrow from each other. They can borrow from the Federal Reserve. So they don't necessarily have to run out and incentivize you as a customer to deposit money with them by paying you a higher rate of return. So they can adjust their pricing on the people they loan money out to faster than the price that they have to pay to get the deposits.
Yeah.
So their margins increase. So yeah, raising interest rates while the economy is still in a growth mode can be very beneficial to financials, potentially. Again, don't turn this into investment advice. You go choose your own adventure. It's not my fault if you buy something and it hurts you. But yeah, that's the issue with financials. There's some other ones that are interesting out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one that initially gets hurt by rising prices, but long-term gets helped. How about utilities?
Sure.
Right? Now, for you and me, who wants to pay more for their utilities? Boo. No.
But we're still going to have to pay it.
Right.
At the end of the day.
Who's going to turn off the lights and the water and the gas?
The cell phone.
No.
I'm not getting rid of my cell phone.
No, I mean, like, there are certain things that have become just how we operate. And, yeah, I think utilities initially take a hit because they have to then, most of the, you know, especially like power and water, those sorts of utilities, they are typically regulated monopolies.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to go through a process of rate adjustment. But when was the last time you saw the utility rate go backwards?
Right. Well, and if money's coming out of other areas and going potentially into a safer, I'm air quoting that, safer area,
right,
the volume can change. Right. And that can naturally affect the price too.
Right. So there you have it. It's just a there. So the rate's going up. Here's the other thing. Initially, it's usually a good sign, right? If the Fed's raising rates, it's because of economic strength, not weakness.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a point at which usually the Fed overshoots. Right? Mm. The soft landing has historically been very difficult to engineer. Remember the soft landing we talked mm-hmm. about before the break, right?
Yep.
It's hard to engineer a soft landing, and rarely is it successful. And if it is successful, I'm going to ask a different question. At what cost was it successful, right? Because if it involves printing $4 trillion, did you really engineer a soft landing, or did you just defer more pain? Right?
It's an interesting theory. Right?
I mean, the credit card is great for instant gratification. It's the paying for the credit card that's tricky. And we could get into lots of nuances about whether or not the Fed ever has to pay it back.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's a question. Honestly, people are like, oh my gosh, all this debt. So do we have to pay it back? Okay. And I believe that from a moral perspective, yes, but we are playing this game of, well, what if we can grow the economy way faster than we grow the debt? Could we just keep paying the minimum payment on our credit card bill? And like, it's like, hey, I have a job and I keep getting a raise. So even though I'm putting more on the credit card, my raises more than cover my ability to make the payments. So we're cool, right? And then I would say, I don't really think we're cool. I think we're just rationalizing our behavior. But that's me being a slightly more conservative financial dude. What can I say?
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, look, I think we've maybe need to talk about some of where the market is headed with all this information. We're staring at higher rates and we're staring at the Fed and their behaviors. How are we going to, as investors, respond? We're going to get into those weeds after this obscene profit break. Stick around. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
We got True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
And I got to stop listening to the news during the breaks. Just sometimes it just drives me up the wall, Matt. I can't
help.
Is
it just sensory overload?
I don't think it's that. It's, let's call it, so every now and then it's almost like principal overload. The last one, I guess there's news about, you know, wanting to change the filibuster rules in the Senate. And I look at this and go, every time that I see one party trying to erode the checks and balances of the system further, my suspicion level climbs. I'm just like, well, why do we want, like, why is it that in the Senate that we want to change filibuster rules? Or why don't we want to go from majority vote to, you know, simple majority or 51? Like, you mean that we can't get an idea good enough to get more than 51 out of 100 people on board with it? Like,
that's
kind of
depressing.
Out of good ideas if that's where we're at.
I agree.
You know, and if it's not that they're good ideas, and it's like, then how have we gotten so many people that are so self-interested or embedded in special interests that we are unwilling or unable to propagate the good ideas?
It seems like every year it gets worse, right?
That's the part, and I'm not going to come on the radio and then try to like discourage people that I realize the system has got warts and pains and problems, because guess what? It's run by us people. And I joke because, you know, I've been in HOA meetings. Heck, I've been the president of an HOA where I used to live, and I've watched the arrows fly and I've caught some of them myself. And I'm looking at this going, these are our neighbors, right? Like, we're supposed to be the ones that we're living together trying to make this thing go. And it's amazing how things can sort of deteriorate to petty. And then I go, well, it doesn't surprise me.
Anytime personal greed can creep into the equation.
It's just, the hope would be that somehow the the group that we bring together could reach a point where the legislation wasn't about the special interest, but it was actually about producing the net overall positive outcome that sort of benefits is the most number of people. Mm-hmm. And that might be the wild card there is, you know, how can we create policy that maximizes the benefit to the most number of people, gives the or minimizes the impact to the most number of people? Right? So we don't need to make the world way harder and make the hill way steeper for a bunch of people, or to disenfranchise a small group. There's just, it's hard to balance, but it's, are we really, maybe there, if we can't pass the laws with that kind of majority, maybe they're just lousy laws.
Yeah.
Like maybe we should focus on working within the laws that we have, or getting rid of the broken ones,
or cleaning up what we have.
Yeah. Like maybe, can we just limit it to like a phone book or something like that? If there's more laws than that, you're like, we need to just come up with better laws. There's too many.
Mm-hmm.
Like nobody's going to remember them all. Go break it. Whatever.
Where did we leave them off at, David, when we went to the obscene profit break?
What were we talking about? You're supposed to track this for me, right? You're my conscience for this.
Oh, we're talking about the markets a little bit. And
talking a lot.
We talked about bonds.
Yep. Don't want to be making loans in an environment where you're going to get paid back with weaker payments. We know the Fed's been at work. We talked about whether or not you really ever see the debt get repaid. We talked about the instant gratification concept of credit cards.
We've had a lot of instant gratification lately. Yep.
I mean, well, and during the break, you and I talked a little bit about, I guess maybe we talked during the break about that.
This is
the question is, do we just have a regular, is this just a regular market cycle where, hey, things go up, they go mm-hmm. down?
I mean, seems like we're kind of in a contraction, right? Like everything's, we've been doing so good for so long, and now the rate hikes,
here's the
things
question.
Are starting
contraction
to tighten up.
Contraction of what?
Of that obscene amount of growth.
Well, I'm going to suggest that the stock market and the economy aren't the same thing.
Okay.
Okay. So for all of our brilliant listeners, right? Because you folks that are listening, y'all are smart. So understand that the stock market is oftentimes a symptom of the economy, but not the cause.
I can get on board with that.
Okay. And so if the economy is doing well, the stock market goes up. Now, there are a lot of people that could say, is the economy doing well? Well, depending on how you define it, parts of the economy, and remember, the United States is a very consumer-centric economy, meaning much of what it is it's the people that buy the stuff that drive the economy, about 70% consumer-driven.
And would you say consumer spending is still pretty high?
Oh, yeah. Consumer spending is high. And if you look, inventories are very, very low.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily have to be a leading indicator.
Well, it's not a leading indicator. It can be a fairly real-time indicator,
mm-hmm.
right? If consumer spending is high, that's telling us that right now the economy is in a position of strength. That doesn't mean that tomorrow will be mm-hmm. stronger. We could peak out at any point here. I think the Fed raising interest rates is in response to where we're at in this total growth cycle. So they're sort of saying, hey, we need to stabilize asset prices. Like we $4 gasoline when a year ago it was under $3.
Mm-hmm.
Like what? It's just those are material impacts. Like energy prices really affect our economy, and so that is bad news to see prices shift that much.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Same.
So we've talked a little bit about futures. So how often are you using futures to help kind of guide future decisions with the markets? Because futures on oil have been lower lately, correct?
Did I read that right?
Yeah.
So, and that's just, are they in contango or backwardation, right? Fun mm-hmm. terms that we talk about. So backwardation means that the future price shows lower than present, and contango means the future price higher than present. So it's a sense of where the direction is headed. So if the price of oil is lower, it would be contango, right?
Hmm.
And I don't know if they use it for oil, but like in the futures for the stock market, that's the terminology.
Right.
And as we look at, I look at the stock market all the time. I don't look at the oil markets. You know, stock markets still are, you know, a little bit higher. But when you see the futures get really close,
mm-hmm.
and here's the thing, they often get pretty close. Like intraday, they cross all the time. And so what you're looking for is directional indication. I like to look at futures markets over the weekend when the markets are closed. Gives me a sense of how the markets are going to open on Mondays.
Gotcha.
Right, so it's kind of interesting, and the markets do close on Saturday for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And they reopen, and I watch them on Sunday, and they're up all Sunday night. So I wake up early.
Is that
on.
Really how you're spending your weekends, David?
What? Everybody does that.
Oh, I don't think so. I'm out there on the boat fishing.
You know,
you're going to convert me one of these days. I'm just going to be sitting there on the laptop.
Not all weekend, no. Okay. I mean, I honestly don't worry about the weekend movement much because I can check a chart and quickly see how that's behaving, and then I can just sort of match the charts up to the news stream and say, well, was there any material news and when did it come out and did the charts respond? That's not super complex to do. So that's just data matching, if you will. Where it gets harder is, well, it's not that harder. Trying to project a longer-term trend, right? Very short-term. Like I could tell you, hey, the markets are likely to open positive because the futures are positive.
Yeah, but
I can't tell you if they're going to close positive based on that. You know,
and we're not day trading either, so maybe not be too relevant.
Right, right. But the purpose of it is to just get a sense of which way the market is leaning, and also to match up the market behavior against the news cycle. It often concerns me when the news cycle isn't in sync with the markets. Right. So you're hearing one thing and you're seeing another, and you're like, well, why is
that? I feel like we've been seeing that kind of a lot lately.
It's really a hard call. The market has been so, if we look at the macro trends, it's like, what's the really big stuff that's
Are we going to get into macros, David?
Not our macros.
Okay.
I'm using it more generically, macro and micro. We have a different, macro means something different in our office because we've got our own sort of special sauce for looking at the total economy, and what we're looking at is systemic risk. That's a whole different.
This is a topic for a different day.
Yeah, it's a whole different radio show. If you guys want to know about systemic risk and how we attempt to manage that in our practice, you email to info@littlejohnfs.
Okay.
And you say we want to hear, you know, do a podcast on the secret sauce of macros, and we can talk about that. Okay. But when we're talking about the macro economy.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And we're trying to discern.
This is a less fun topic. We really do need to do a radio show one of these days on our secret sauce, right?
We can, you know, or we can do a video series and throw it on YouTube or something like that. But the idea is that you want to see how the macro situation is playing out, and then see if the news cycle fits. So, what's been playing into our macro scenario for a long time, a really long time.
The Fed?
Yeah. Let's do this.
Cliffhanger.
Last break,
yeah. Rewind.
Last break, we will come back and we'll talk. The Fed is behaving different. What does it actually mean? Well, we may not know, but we're going to fake it until we get there. Right after this break. This is Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
Yeah, True Wealth on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, home stretch of the True Wealth Show. We're stoked that you've been joining us. Dave Littlejohn in studio with the Whiz Kid.
Matt Dixon.
All right, gang. We are talking about the markets have been really interesting. And here's kind of where I wanted to get to for the whole show. So if you're just joining us, you're just in time. If you missed the rest of it, grab the podcast at littlejohnfs.com tomorrow, posted there under the Educate tab. Where we get all kinds of good stuff posted there, by the way. You can join the mailing list if you want to get the latest in whatever the latest is. I don't want to call it the greatest because who knows? Maybe this is the greatest show we'll ever finish right here. We'll start with this one. It'll just be downhill, you figure?
I think it's going to go uphill, David.
All right, let's do it. So
I think you're about to blow the listeners' minds.
Doubt it.
Oh,
I am going to tell you that I think that we've had a major, what I will call a regime change or a material shift in the markets. Okay. And over the course of my career, which started really in late 1999, and then I remember watching the dot-com inflation and implosion, and then watching the build up to 2008 and the real estate inflation and the financial crisis that followed and then the implosion that followed, then the whole process of reinflating bubbles all over the world through central bank intervention, right? So the European Central Bank started back in, I want to say, 2011 with the Greeks crisis, where Greece basically defaulted in the European Union. And then we had the pigs. People don't even remember that. Like, it was Portugal, Ireland, and Greece, Spain, and one other one in there too.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, another, well, whatever. So but the pigs were going on in there. And then we had, of course, the election cycle that transitioned from the Obama administration. It was an assumption that Hillary would take the baton. Trump was sort of the dark horse surprise. Material changes from a more global agenda to a more nationalist agenda, back to the present administration, a pandemic that just won't quit, right? And what have we seen since 2008? What is the one thread of common behavior?
I think I know where you're going with this, and I could be way wrong.
Hit
but it.
It
sounds like you're saying the Fed has been spoon-feeding the economy and trying to take the volatility out of the markets so that we don't have another huge crisis.
I don't know if it was specifically for the stock market, but it didn't harm the stock market. We have talked about the Fed put for years. Now, a put is the equivalent of letting somebody purchase the right to sell at a higher price, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the Fed put was this idea that the markets were going to keep going up because the Fed was stopping everything with really, really cheap money.
That's true.
And then it became, you can buy bonds and not worry about the risk very much because the Fed was going to keep buying them from everybody. So the Fed became the buyer of last resort for treasury bonds in the form of quantitative easing. And so the Federal Reserve balance sheet ballooned from under $1 trillion to over $9 trillion since 2008. We've watched our national debt balloon from somewhere, I think, about the same time when the Bush and Obama handoff, I think of Bush administration, it was like $4 trillion of debt up to $8 trillion. And then it's grown from $8 trillion to over $20 trillion in the last several administrations. Trump administration, by the way, doesn't get a pass. Massive debt load added during the Trump administration. So, why am I carving that out? Specifically because when you say, oh, well, first after President Bush leaves office and Obama takes over, sure, there's the Great Recession of 2008 and Obama's on the watch and there's all this government spending. So the temptation is to say, oh, well, it happened under a blue administration, right? And then the stock market, continues to rise under the red administration. Careful, right? Because there's lots and lots of spending there. So nobody gets a pass on that one. What we know now is the Federal Reserve has gone from discussing when it would begin to raise rates to starting to prep us for it to actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so for the first time in a long time, the Fed has said, we need to normalize things. The economy has enough wind in its sails that we can't continue to provide super, 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 super lifetime historically low interest rates that have been driving up real estate prices, that have justified multiple expansion of the stock market. We've talked about the valuation for some of our super high flying tech companies. My favorite one, and I like this because I find Elon Musk super fascinating and brilliant. I think the cars are really interesting and cool. I think the company is insanely overvalued for Tesla cars. And people will look at me and they want to like fight me over it because it's that kind of passion. I'm like, it's got a 350 PE right now. That means that company has to earn $350 to pay me back a dollar.
That's nuts. And that's like $350 of earnings.
Earnings.
Not
right?
Even like just.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay, that's insanely high. But if your interest rate is zero at the bank, then, well, I can get paid a dollar for a $350 investment. Then I guess it's better than zero at the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the mispricing of risk. And I believe that we have material headwinds for this market to adjust and to digest, rather. And here's what I'm going to suggest. And I don't know that if I'm pretty sure it will happen. I don't know when. Okay, and so I can't say this is not to be investment advice, this is to be an investment notice, that historically speaking, if rates begin to go down, then companies better keep getting bigger. because the multiple that's going to be applied historically will shrink in these environments. And if the multiple shrinks faster than the earnings can grow, the stock market can decline in value.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw conditions like this before in 98 and 99. Super high valuations. Warren Buffett was considered an idiot back then, and he was beyond, he was just out of date and out of touch.
And they thought that for a while, a couple years.
There was 2-3 years where Warren Buffett was underperforming the market and he'd lost his touch and the Oracle of Omaha was no longer relevant. And then 2000 came and the dot-com bubble broke and NASDAQ fell by 80-something percent. And all of a sudden, Warren Buffett didn't look so dumb after all. He was just a patient value investor and his day in the sun returned. And I don't know if this is a bubble and when it pops, if it is, but I will tell you that history may not actually repeat itself, but it often rhymes.
Ooh.
And boy, these valuations sure rhyme a lot with things I've seen in the past that were really, really high. And the difference with what drove the dot-com bubble versus what concerns me about this one is the dot-com bubble interest rates were not nearly so low. They were much higher.
Hmm.
And when everything popped, the Fed had to start lowering rates to stimulate the economy.
We don't get that luxury
We're
this time around.
We're raising rates into a strengthening economy right now. And so I don't know how much longer that bubble can inflate, but I'm just telling you, be aware, valuations are thin. Anyway, that's it. The music's playing. We are out of time. We got to run. Matt, how do they reach us if they want to learn more?
541-375-0898.
All right, gang. And again, spread the word. Get that podcast downloaded. And let us know if you got a fun idea for the show at info@littlejohnfs. Until next time, this has been David Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you've been listening to True Wealth.
The preceding program was paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.